with my eyes closed, then set the glass back down on the table, my mother asks me if it's been a long day, implying that I usually change before pouring wine, which is not that often, though more, it seems, since I've moved back in this house.
You know, everybody's talking about that body pulled from the net.
Yeah, that right.
Someone sent me a video of the fishing boat it was on.
You know I can't talk about the investigation.
Oh, yeah, I know. Well, there's talking and then there's talking.
Fine.
Okay, fine.
I tell her what I can, sparing her the details that might make her lose her appetite. It doesn't matter that she was married to a cop for 35 years. My father never brought work home, and she was happy to limit their conversations to me and my sister and what was for dinner. He would promise to do some yard work over the weekend, and she would offer to help. Then they'd move about the house together, silent partners in lockstep. But things are different when the cop is your child and not your husband. The protective instincts flow in the opposite direction. Now my mother seeks every minute detail so she knows how much to worry about me, or how little. I break the news to her gently, that Peter Walsh was murdered, that there are no real leads yet, except perhaps the shape and material of the murder weapon. And that's all I say. I leave out the part about the forensics team looking for anything in the room at the Four Points that might have been used to cause that wound on Peter Walsh's neck, the one that crushed his artery and his windpipe, cutting off oxygen, flooding his lungs with blood, killing him before he hit the water. I've already checked the photos I took of the room with my phone. Nothing jumped out at me. The lamps on either side of the bed are decorative, shaped like pineapples, and made of wood. Nothing was missing from any of the fixtures, the bathroom rods, the toilet paper stand. None of the furniture appeared to be damaged, missing parts. So far, no long, smooth objects have turned up. I ask my mother how long before dinner, and she tells me at least an hour. She hasn't even started to prepare the fish. It's just past 7, but she didn't know how late I would be. I tell her not to worry. I put my gun in the lockbox, top off the wine, return the bottle to the fridge, and take my glass with me to my bedroom. She nods and tells me I should take a shower after being at the morgue.
Go wash the death off you.
I promise I will. But instead, I go out the back door to the driveway and pop my trunk. I grab the box that's been riding around with me for 2 days, prop it on my hip, slam the door back down, and carry it inside to my room. I should be thinking about Peter Walsh and Brooke's situation, being at the Four Points when he was murdered. I should be worried about her and Jamie not being able to find out more about her lover David Paul. Tyler was right. There are hundreds of David Pauls, but none that match his profile. He has no digital footprint. Jamie said he's only seen that when someone uses an alias. He asked if I'm sure the man he's searching for didn't use a fake name. He went on about how sometimes people use their real first name, but fake the last, or in this case, he might have reversed them. Paul David, maybe, or Davidson. He asked if the man would have needed to answer to that name around people who knew him, and I tell him yes, but not more than that. Not that this man is my friend's lover who heard a murder in the room next door. I should be worried about Brooke and how this is sitting with her. From the description she gave me of their love affair, this has to be tearing her up. This man may have lied to her from the start, wanting to have this affair without any repercussions, without any risk. When he knew everything about her, where she lived, her husband's name, he had a copy of her book. But instead, my mind is right where it's been since we got that tip. And, if I'm being honest, it's right where it's been for 15 years. Because I always believed what the caller said, that Eve Shea was murdered. I open the box that contains evidence from the case of Eve Shea, and then I hear my mother call out from the kitchen.
I don't hear the shower.
I go to the bathroom and run the water, then return to the bed. Eve was on my mind at the morgue while I stared at Peter Walsh, this time under a white sheet, on a cold metal table, the wound on his neck dark purple. The voice on the tip line sounded like a woman, but Jamie said it's very possible that it was altered for gender as well. There's no way to tell one way or another. I imagine if I wanted to hide my voice, that would be the first thing I would do. filter it through some machine that made me sound like a man.
Her name was Eve Shea. I suspect she was murdered.
I start where I always do, replaying the events of that night in my head, the way they come from my own memories. Sitting on the bed in Eve's room while she curled Brooke's hair, and Brooke told me I should put on lip gloss. But I don't look at these memories in isolation. I overlay them with the things that I learned after she disappeared, and after her body was found, and again when I became a cop 9 years ago. That Brooke's excitement that night was because she was planning to meet Jeremy Ashbourne after the bonfire. And Eve's secrecy, the way she had been indifferent about the night, and yet had chosen the red and white striped shirt. I overlay every moment of that night with the fact that Eve was pregnant, and that neither Brooke nor I had any idea about it, especially who the father was. I go next to the files about Connor and Luke, and the one about Mr. Rosario and the way he was helping Eve with her scholarships. I pull the interview notes again and read, though I know it all by heart. When Mr. Rosario was questioned about Eve, he lashed out, told us to look at the messages and calls between Eve and Jeremy Ashbourne. He told us that Eve was going over to his house to use his computer. But was that really the reason why? Mr. Rosario was on the school board, and in the file, in his interview notes, in his statement about Jeremy Ashbourne and the reason he came to teach in East Bay. None of us knew this back then, especially not the students. I can't imagine more parents knew because no one would have wanted him to be around their kids. The school board had still voted to hire him. He hadn't done anything illegal. It was just a note in his file, an accusation from grad school when he was a teaching assistant. One of his students reported a sexual advance he made. Jeremy Ashbourne claimed it was a misunderstanding, and it became a he said, she said thing. It was so many years ago, well before the Me Too movement. It didn't escalate, but Mr. Rosario remembered. After Eve's body was found and questions were raised about his integrity and his intentions toward her, this note came in very handy. I can almost hear Mr. Rosario giving this statement to the police.
What about Jeremy Ashbourne? He seems to like girls this age.
Both men, Mr. Rosario and Jeremy Ashbourne, refused to give a DNA sample to rule them out as the father of Eve's unborn child. There wasn't enough evidence for a warrant, and when her death was ruled an accidental drowning, that was the end of it. But Mr. Rosario's statement was enough for the police to dig into Jeremy Ashbourne. Then his alibi fell apart, and Brooke was forced out of the shadows. It's all right here in the box, in the files. And I pull them out now, flipping them open, as if I'm going to find something new, even though I've read them hundreds of times. I think next to the bonfire, and the boys who came to sit on our blanket, and the kiss that made me so angry I ran away even as Eve called out after me.
Carrie, stop!
I ran all the way home, but then snuck out of my room and walked to the pier, the last place that Eve was seen that night. There's one file in the box that I need to see. It has printed photos that were collected from the kids who'd been at the pier that night. Most of them had taken pictures on their phones and had uploaded them to Facebook. All of those had been printed out by the police. At the time, they were looking for pictures of Eve so they could figure out when she was there, who she spoke to, and when and how she left. None of the photos provided any guidance to those questions. Eve was only in one of them. What they did find helped to corroborate the alibis of both Connor and Luke, two of the possible suspects in the case. Connor was in several pictures well past midnight, and he had his receipt from the purchase of a fried dough at 12:45. There were pictures of Luke as well, a selfie taken by Bryn Ellis kissing his cheek, her arm wrapped around his neck, like she'd won a prize at a fair. Luke seemed in a daze, his eyes looking to the side, wide and glazed from all of the alcohol. But that helped confirm her story that he had been with her through most of the evening. Lisa Calder vouched for Connor, saying she drove him home soon after Eve left, or so she thought. No one was really sure what happened to Eve after she entered the bathroom at the arcade. Still, I knew the secret to Eve's death, her possible murder, was somewhere in this file, hiding in the evidence from the pier. It had to be. That, and the splinters in her back, the scrapings under her nails, and the rope marks found around her waist. Not far from the shore are moorings where people tie their boats, and wooded rafts anchored with rope. You can see them floating off the private docks. The Emmy concluded that she got tangled in one of the ropes, her back hitting against the wood. The wounds were all post-mortem, after she drowned. And the scrapings under nails? That was varnish, probably from nail polish, they concluded in the final report. But just like the conclusion that she'd gone into the water when she didn't know how to swim, I'd never seen Eve paint her nails, not in the 4 years I'd been her best friend. The shower is still running. Steam is filling the room. I hear my mother call from down the hall about dinner.
Dinner in 15 minutes.
I pull out all of the photographs and lay them on my bed, seeing the faces of the past staring back at me. My eyes begin to glaze over them. I've seen them so many times, I have to force myself to look at them and go over each one. Faces of 18-year-olds, drunk and stoned, smeared mascara from eyes that watered from the wind and the sulfur that lingered in the air, groomed hair that was now wild from the moisture of the sea. Shoes were off and shirts unbuttoned. I trace each face with my hand, making a note of the names. My mother calling again from down the hall.
Carrie, dinner!
And then my finger lands on a face, one of the several I had not been able to put a name to. We weren't the only ones who went to the pier. The summer kids came there as well, and people walking the boardwalk from Crichton. A breath rushes into my lungs.
Carrie, it's getting cold!
And now, finally, a name to put to the face. I look again to be sure. 15 years is a long time. But no. I'm certain. The girl I'm looking at is Renee Walsh.
Chapter 22. Brooke, July 2nd, 2025. I leave Carrie and drive home, pulling over by the dunes just for a moment so I can catch my breath. My God, what a mess this has become. I couldn't help but feel the way I did back then, when I'd lied to the police about where I'd been that night, how I'd gone home after the fireworks, even though I'd made an elaborate plan to stay out somewhere else. Me and Eve, using each other for cover. The police had wanted to know where it was I'd planned to go, even if I didn't end up going. Again, I lied and said I just wanted to be out past curfew, that I was always planning to go home eventually. And where was Eve planning to go, with the freedom our plan had bought her before my mother told her father and sent him running down the beach after her? That time, I told the truth. I had no idea. Eve had a secret, I knew it, but Eve always had some secret inside her, even if it was just what she was thinking. She wasn't like the rest of us when we were 18, spewing out every thought we had like they were uniquely inspired. We were ridiculous, the things we thought. The sun is getting low over the Atlantic. It's past 7, and Aiden has already texted once about dinner. He was so goddamn nice about it.
No rush, sweetheart. Just let me know if you're coming home to eat.
I don't deserve him. Maybe that's why I don't really love him. Of course, I told Carrie I did. She needed to hear it. She needed to know how conflicted I was about the affair, and that I had changed since high school and the things I did when I was desperate for Jeremy's affection. That I was a different person now, one who just slipped a little. That's all. Carrie would understand that. Her marriage had fallen apart. I'm sure that had something to do with our past, the ghosts of Eve that haunt this town. Carrie probably still obsesses over that kiss on the beach that made her leave early. She probably wonders what would have happened if she'd stayed. I pull out my phone and text Aiden that I'll be back soon. And yes, we'll have dinner together, my love. Anything you want. First dinner. Then the walk on the beach I know he'll want to have before the sun goes down. I'll pull him into bed, then leave him with his book on the history of something. Aiden loves to read about the past. He says it always informs the future. I thought then that he had no idea how true that was. And when he begins to doze off, because he's an old man and that's what old men do, I'll go downstairs and think of what to do next. One thing at a time. I tell myself as I stare at the water from the shoulder of the access road. My hand hovers over the start button. My foot is on the brake. But then I stop and close my eyes, letting the memories come. It's the same feeling I had in my gut then, and in the days and weeks after Eve disappeared, and then when her body was found, that I was trapped in a maze, one I had willingly entered, but now I couldn't see a way out. Aiden can't know about this. It will be the end of my marriage and my fledgling writing career. I hear my mother's words from earlier that day when she was complaining about Tyler living at home.
And you, all that money on college, and you don't even have a job. After everything we gave you.
She was right. This is how women fuck themselves. Having babies, quitting jobs to be better companions to their husbands. God forbid those marriages end and they have nothing. They turn 40, 50, and get called all kinds of things. Like they might as well jump off a cliff. What would I do if I lost Aiden now, after I'd agreed to leave my career and come back to this place? I was so stupid. Stupid now and stupid then. Carrie won't help me for much longer. I know it. The kiss on the beach and then the lie I told when they first asked me where I was that night. Carrie stopped speaking to me when she found out. I'm sure she justifies it. How could I lie when our friend had disappeared? But I think she was more hurt that I hadn't told her about my plans that night. Only Eve. And then, that kiss. We were closer friends, me and Eve. That's the truth. But I can't call her out on this. It was cringy the way my lie came apart that summer. After Mr. Rosario told them Jeremy had been working with Eve at his house, they asked for his alibi, then found the holes in it. The Easy Pass records that had him driving down the interstate, the I-95, late that night, getting to East Bay right around midnight, just after Eve was last seen at the pier, then returning to the conference the next morning in time for his first session. He'd had no choice but to tell them why he'd come back. He later told me that after he gave them my name, they wouldn't let him leave or make a call. That's why he couldn't warn me. The detectives came to my house and asked to bring me back in for some questions. I was 18, so my parents couldn't come with me for the interview. They stayed home and scrambled to call a lawyer. I told them I didn't need one, but what did I know? I'm sure my father saw right through my protestations. My mother as well, if I'm being honest. She has a sixth sense when her kids have deceived her. I told the police I'd lied before about my plan. I used Eve for cover because I was going to meet Jeremy. We were planning to spend the night together. It would be our first time. I swore to them that he had not been inappropriate with me during the school year, that he'd never tried to kiss me or anything like that. I told them exactly what they needed to hear to keep Jeremy out of trouble, that I was the one who pursued him after school ended, that I was the one who persuaded him to see me, that I was the one who tried to kiss him, and that the night Eve disappeared, we stayed together all night, just like we'd planned, making love until the sun started to rise and Jeremy had to leave to get back to Boston on time. I drove home then and slipped into bed unnoticed. That was why my parents and Tyler thought I'd been home after the fireworks. They weren't lying, they'd just made the assumption. They had nothing to do with any of this. That's what I said in my statement. Jeremy refused to give his DNA, though he swore he'd never slept with Eve, never tried to seduce her. Yes, he'd had her to his house to help her with her scholarship essays, and yes, he'd offered her a beer once and again, but she was an adult. We all were, weren't we? Me, Brooke, and Carrie, adults. But we were so fucking stupid. I knew that the moment after I gave my statement, when I went to see Jeremy at his house.
What did you tell them?
Don't worry. I told them we were together all night. That you didn't leave until the sun came up.
Oh, fuck! Okay.
What did you think I would do?
I didn't know, Brooke. You were so angry that night.
Of course I was. But I would never do anything to hurt you.
Stop.
What? It's over now. It's all out in the open. We don't have to hide anymore.
Brooke, stop it.
Can't you just hold me? Eve is dead, Jeremy. She's dead.
Shh. Okay. Come here. You know, Brooke, we can't do this. I can't do this.
But I love you.
Seriously. Brooke, stop.
Why?
We can't do this anymore.
What? No.
We can't. Think about it.
So, this whole year, all of it was what?
Stop being so naive. Jesus, Brooke. This is why I could never give you what you wanted. You're just a little girl, aren't you?
Well, then what does that make you?
Just stop. It's over. We gave our statements. They have everything now.
No, they don't. No, they don't. They're still missing one thing. The truth about where you really were that night.
Part 3, Chapter 23, Eve, July 4th, 2010. I didn't wave back at Mrs. Rosario. Something about it creeped me out. I walked faster, but then began to slow as their house disappeared behind me. I stayed close to the side, ready to duck into the dunes or a driveway if I saw a car coming. But my father's last text said he'd gone home, and...
We'll talk about this tomorrow, Eve.
Like suddenly he was going to show up and try to parent me. The wind blowing off the ocean reset my brain. That's what my mother used to say. From before I can remember, any time I was sad or angry, she would tell me that feelings would always pass, that every emotion had a lifespan, and that I could make it shorter or longer depending on what I did with my body. She taught me how to hold my wrists under cold water. Really cold, she told me, or to go outside and run as fast as I could down the street, look up at the sun or the moon, watch the clouds passing through them, find a friend to play a game, put on my favorite song or TV show.
It's all it takes, Eve. One small thing and the colors of the entire world can change.
I would watch her do the things that she had told me. Sometimes she would sit on the back porch and just stare up at the stars. Even in the winter, she would sit outside without as much as a coat or blanket. She would let her body get so cold it would begin to shiver, and her lips would turn blue. She said by the time she came inside, her worried brain had been distracted by the cold on her skin and all of the stars that might be home to other worlds. She said she wouldn't feel sad anymore, but instead, she would wonder about those worlds and which one of them she would be going to when she left this one. When my father and I first came to East Bay, the inn was the place I always went to reset my brain. To me, it was like magic. Most of the summer people came in July and August. They stayed for days or even weeks at the inn. Others owned places here and would come and go for the entire season. I wondered about the summer people the way my mother wondered about the stars, where they lived the rest of the year, and if maybe those other places were even more beautiful. I watched them come and go at the inn as I worked, nearly every summer since I arrived. And as much as Brooke hated how close I was with her father, she was the one to suggest it. The summer after ninth grade, she asked Mr. Lowry to find me a job, and he did. He let me help in the kitchen. At the end of that summer, I started to wait tables. I'd been watching the older staff for several weeks and knew the menu inside and out. The money was better on the floor. People were generous with their tips. It was that summer that I met a girl from Rhode Island. Her name was Renee, and she was thin with dirty blonde hair that was straight as a razor's edge. She was having dinner with her family one night in the dining room. It was raining out, so no one was on the terrace. They were seated by the window, all of them looking outside at the angry water. I couldn't tell if they were disappointed that the weather was interrupting their beach holiday, or if they were mesmerized by the beauty of the storm. The girl's mother asked my name, and her father asked if I was from East Bay. They wanted to know things about the town because they had just arrived the day before. What was the best place to eat? Where did the locals like to go? Her mother said those were always the best places. I tried to answer, though I had no idea about restaurants and shops being a girl who had to work all summer to buy clothes for school. The next summer, Mr. Lowry let me work at the reservation desk. I had a lot more interaction with the guests who would come to ask for all kinds of things. More recommendations about what to do in town, how to rent the boats out by the dock, where they could shop for local art if they could change their room for a better view. Sometimes they had complaints about the hot water running out or the toilet not flushing well. They always wanted more towels. Renee and her family came to East Bay for the same week in June, so they were there that summer when I was working at the registration desk. I learned their name, Quinn. I learned that Renee was a senior in high school, and that her brother was attending college in California. And while the family lived in Newport, their house was not on the water. Plus, she said, they came to East Bay to be away from the people they knew and the things that they normally did. They came to be in another world, and this made me think about my mother. I decided right then that I liked her. When I saw her again the next summer, she came up to me and said hello. I'd been working in the guest shop beside Mrs. Lowry. I knew it had to do with the friendship that had formed between me and her husband. It was one of those things I thought I should try to ignore, as if letting that into my brain would do the opposite of the things my mother had taught me. Everyone knew Mrs. Lowry was crazy. No one would put a name to what kind of crazy she was, except for Brooke, with all of her diagnoses. It hadn't been easy. There were days when the gift shop was busy and I could ignore Mrs. Lowry. She would stay behind the register, and I would walk through the store, straightening the things that the guests had looked at and returned to a shelf the wrong way, or clothing they tried on that they left in the dressing room, sometimes back on a hanger, sometimes in a crumpled pile on the floor. I also took care of the inventory, making a note of everything we sold, which on some days was close to nothing, but on other days it was important. We could go through 2 boxes of sunscreen and have none left in the storeroom. I didn't mind the work, except for Mrs. Lowry on the days when it was slow. I never knew what I was going to get. If she was going to ignore me, the two of us sitting in silence behind the register, or if she would talk to me about the things that popped into her mind, sometimes telling me stories about her childhood, or about Brooke and Tyler when they were younger. She talked to me like I was one of her closest friends, and then I would see a shift in her eyes. They would narrow into laser beams, burning a hole right through me, like she had suddenly remembered that I wasn't her closest friend, but a teenage girl who had befriended her husband. Mrs. Lowry terrified me. The next summer, I begged Mr. Lowry to let me work in the restaurant again. I told him I needed the tips to help pay for college. Finally, I was given 5 shifts a week waiting tables, and I was grateful. I even made a point of saying hello to Mrs. Lowry in the gift shop. It was that day I ran into Renee Quinn again. She was having lunch outside on the patio with a boy, a young man. I'd heard her family wasn't coming to the inn this year. Renee was in college and had rented a house with some friends. They were looking for summer jobs, just like the rest of us. She wasn't sitting in my station, but I went over to greet them.
Eve! There you are! I was afraid you weren't working here this summer.
Yeah, I'm here! Wait, how was your first year of college?
Amazing!
Oh, I'm so glad.
And look, I brought my boyfriend. This is Peter. Peter Walsh.
Chapter 24. Carrie, July 2nd, 2025. I don't take a shower. I don't eat dinner with my mother, the fish with vegetables from her garden. I tell her a lie as I rush out the door. Something's come up with the new case. Renee Walsh was at the pier the night Eve died. She was in a photo pulled from a Facebook account belonging to a girl on the soccer team. She was standing in the arcade by the whack-a-mole, looking at the girls posing for the photo. One of them is Lisa Calder. Luke Kendrick is in the photo too, off to the side next to Renee. I knew Lisa's statement by heart, how she told Eve about her father being on the beach, then convinced her to come with them to the pier. How Eve left the blanket, my blanket, in the trunk of her car. She didn't see anything else that was useful, except Eve talking to Connor. She claimed she drove Connor home after Eve left, after he bought the fried dough a few shops down on the boardwalk, after he was seen grabbing Eve's arm. Lisa married a guy from our class, Ricky Pullman. They have 2 kids. She went to dental school and works as a hygienist. I just saw her in town yesterday at the diner with Bryn Ellis. Tyler Lowry was working the counter. I don't let my mind spin theories. Renee Walsh told Newport PD that she and Peter had been here before, to the East Bay Inn. I assumed she meant recently, after they were married. She couldn't be more than 20 in that photo. Maybe it wasn't relevant that she was here the night Eve disappeared. Maybe she didn't know that Eve turned up dead. She would have been gone by late August. It didn't make national news. I doubt any of the summer people even heard about Eve. East Bay kept it quiet, just like Peter Walsh, because death, especially drownings or killings, scare away the tourists. Except she'd left the morgue after seeing me and Rob come in. She must have known then that something about her husband's death was suspicious. She hasn't been answering my calls all day. I drive across town to the other side of Elm Street, where the houses are laid out on square blocks of quarter acres. One-story ranches with small lawns in the front and back, fences along the sides. They're white and well-maintained. Lisa answers the door, letting out a burst of noise from a blaring video game and cold from the air conditioner. She's surprised to see me, still in my uniform. When I ask her if we can talk, her eyes grow wide, and she wants to know if it's about the body that got pulled from the trawling line. The whole town's talking, she says, as if I didn't already know. She yells to her husband that she'll be right back. She doesn't answer when he asks where the hell she's going. Instead, she rolls her eyes and pulls the door closed behind her. I have the file in my hand and take out the photo. I don't give her any context, but point to the young woman who's leaning against the wall behind the whack-a-mole, looking at Lisa and her friends from the soccer team. I ask if she knows this woman or recognizes her, but then she gasps and covers her mouth with her hand.
Oh my God, that's from the night Eve Shay disappeared, the night she drowned.
Yes.
Let me see it.
Lisa takes the photo from my hand and draws it closer to her face. Then she slowly shakes her head.
I don't remember her. I definitely didn't know her. I don't even remember this photo. Who took it?
One of your friends, but it doesn't matter. Are you sure you don't remember anything about this woman? Maybe there was a man with her?
Carrie, what does this have to do with the dead guy?
I take the picture from her and slip it back in the file, my heart sinking a little. What was I hoping she would say? That Renee Quinn was there with Peter Walsh? That Peter Walsh knew Eve? And that somehow his being murdered in the room next to Brooke and her lover wasn't a coincidence? Yes, that the two murders are somehow linked. The thought is absurd when I let it play out in my mind. This is a small town. The Four Points is the perfect place for an affair. I can't think of a better one within 100 miles. I didn't even know it existed. I try to hide my disappointment as I ask her more questions that might jog her memory. I know it's been a long time. I want to confirm a few things from that night.
Sure, okay.
I run down the facts that she gave in her interview about the beach and the car and the blanket, then about the events at the pier, Connor and Eve fighting, then Luke blocking the door, and then the rest of it. Okay. You said you drove Connor home, that he was drunk.
Yeah, I remember. He was hammered and he had this fried dough thing in his hand. You know, the kind they sell on the pier?
I nod. I know the place well, just past the arcade. It's still there. We take Sylvie to the pier in the summer and she begs for them the moment she smells the fryer. I suppose I should say that we used to take her, because now we go separately during our parenting time. There is no more we.
I remember because his clothes were a mess. There was powdered sugar all over his red shirt and blue shorts, and one of his idiot friends had dumped Gatorade over his head. His father told him to take everything off in the laundry room so he wouldn't track stuff up the stairs, something about the expensive carpet runner and how his mother would have a fit if she woke up to the mess. You remember her, right? She was kind of a bitch.
I take a beat and think about the statements in the file. Mrs. Rosario said she was in the kitchen with her husband when Connor got home. Did she lie to solidify Connor's alibi? The time he got home? So, Mrs. Rosario wasn't there?
Nope, just his dad.
You're sure?
Yeah, I went inside because Connor invited me and, well, Connor was pretty hot and he and Eve were over, so I thought, why not? But when we walked into the kitchen, there was Mr. Rosario at the sink.
That late?
Yeah, I don't know, he was cleaning up, maybe from Connor's party. But he was there for sure. I remember being disappointed. He told Connor to take off the clothes and then said something to me like, thanks for getting him home, which I knew was a polite way of telling me to leave. It would have ended badly anyway. Like I said, Connor was pretty messed up.
And Mrs. Rosario wasn't there. You're sure? Maybe in another room or...
No, I already told you. Why are you going over all of this again?
Maybe I'm making too much of it. I would lie to protect Sylvie. In a heartbeat. I shift gears and go back to the pier, ignoring Lisa's questions about why I'm looking into the case again. What about Bryn? You two have stayed pretty tight all these years. I see you together a lot with your kids now.
We are. Lifelong friends.
Bryn said she was with Luke that night, after the pier. Did you see them leave together?
Yeah.
Are you sure?
I don't remember exactly. I know I saw them hooking up at the arcade.
But you didn't see them actually leave.
Carrie, stop. Why does this matter? I was there with Connor after Luke and Bryn were both gone. That much I know. And I didn't see Eve leave the arcade. We were glued to the Donkey Kong. Do you remember it? It was right by the door. I would have seen her pass me. I had her blanket in my car, and I remember thinking that I needed to give it back to her. If Luke left first, he couldn't have gone after her, right? Is that what you're thinking? Is there new evidence?
I want to say yes, but then I realize that's not actually true. That tip isn't evidence of anything. When I don't answer, and probably look as crazy as I feel, Lisa studies me with concern. She reaches out and gently rubs my arm.
Carrie, Eve drowned that night. I know it's hard with the fourth almost here, and now that man's body found in the water, just like Eve, but...
But what?
Maybe you should get some...
Some what?
Some help.
Good night, Lisa. I leave her there on the front steps and walk quickly to my car. I get inside and close the door, then catch a glimpse of myself in the rearview mirror. I haven't slept for days, haven't showered, and in my eyes I see what Lisa saw, and I think, holy shit, Carrie, what are you doing? Maybe she's right. Maybe they all are. But then I see a text from Jamie.
Hey, we just got an updated audio forensics report. They recovered some additional content. Call me.
I forget about Lisa Calder and the shrink and Rob and all of the doubts about what I'm doing. I gasp in a quick breath, then hit the call button.
Chapter 25. Brooke, July 2nd, 2025. Aiden is waiting for me when I walk in the door. He's made dinner, and that's waiting too. It smells like chicken and potatoes. Comfort food. I hear him call out when my keys fall into the ceramic bowl in the mudroom.
Brooke? Sweetheart?
Be right there.
The words barely leave my mouth, which is bone dry. I've done this before. I know how to hide around my husband. But this time, I don't know. The worry on my face and the thoughts that are sitting right behind my eyes feel bold and bare, like they might defy me. Thoughts about what Carrie told me, how Peter Walsh died, the wound on his neck, the suspected homicide. Time is running out before they'll need to question Aiden about that night, when I left, when I returned, how I lied about going to a book group. And without David Paul to corroborate my story, this will all fall on me. What I heard and saw that night, and even where I was. Carrie didn't have to say it, but I'm not just the only witness to a possible homicide. I'm my own alibi. I'm standing, frozen, in the foyer, my purse still hanging around my shoulder, when I hear Aiden again.
Sweetheart?
Coming!
I drop my purse beside the key bowl on the small table beneath the mirror, purposefully avoiding it. I can't stand to look at myself. I walk to the kitchen and feel my heart break when I see Aiden standing there in an apron, the chicken cooling on the counter and two pots simmering on the stove behind him. He smiles and opens his arms as if to say, "Look what I've done! Isn't it amazing? And all for you." A familiar voice enters my head, one I haven't heard for years, the voice that came to me after Eve's death, the one that guided me out of this place, through college and my career, the one that enabled me to lock up my feelings about East Bay and be a different version of myself. But then, I let my guard down. I was exhausted from keeping so much behind a barricade. I wanted to feel joy again. It wasn't easy, but it had been possible in New York. As much as he loved history, Aiden was so good at not looking back at his own life, at being right here in the moment. He had things he didn't want to feel about the past as well. We had an unspoken agreement to love the people we'd become and not ask questions about who we used to be. Thank God, that voice is back, whispering, "You know how to hide." I feel the smile peel across my face. I walk to my husband and kiss him on the lips, pull him into a tight hug, then whisper in his ear, "What did I do to deserve you?" We eat at the table, he said, in the dining room. It's hot as hell outside, and we both agree to enjoy the air conditioning, then take a walk later, though I hope time gets away from us. We speak of the dead body found at the inn and the updates we've heard today. Most of it is gossip, but some sounds real, like the fact that it might not be an accident. I pretend to be surprised at this, and when silence comes between us, I divert his attention with talk of Eve.
This whole thing, I just can't stop thinking about Eve.
Oh, sweetheart, of course it's brought back memories. I'm so sorry.
I feel a sudden burst of love for my husband. It comes and goes like that, and I'm so grateful for it. I feel tears pooling in the corners of my eyes. I wipe them away before he notices.
I think about it sometimes, too. My boys were up at the inn that night. I let them stay late in that awful game room when their mother was away visiting her sister.
I was with her until just past 10, when the fireworks ended.
I watched them from the porch, right here, right outside.
He points toward the sliding doors that lead to the porch and the beach, and I look there, to the ocean that's lit up by the setting sun and the rising moon. I feel Aiden watching my face, and I hold a mournful smile and reflective gaze, though inside I feel a storm. 15 years ago, Aiden was married, living in this same house with his wife and sons who were just 6 years younger than me. I didn't know him except through my father and the construction projects at the inn. I didn't think about him, not for a single second. He was irrelevant to me. I feel the next question coming before he even says it. I shouldn't have opened this door.
Where did you go after the beach that night?
I shrug my shoulders like it's nothing. Like I don't remember every single second of what happened after I left Eve at the bonfire. How I got my car from the Rosario's driveway. How I was so filled with anticipation, I didn't even feel the alcohol surging through my blood. I drove across town to Jeremy's house by the train station. He told me not to park in front where the neighbors could see, so I found a spot on the next block. I knew where he kept the key. I'd been going there for weeks. I can see now why. Jeremy wasn't finished tormenting me. We would talk and eat and drink. Sometimes we would watch a movie or YouTube videos. I would move closer to him, and he would move away. That was our dance. He didn't want me to stop pursuing him, but he wouldn't give me what I wanted. Until that night. I drove to his house, then walked around to the back. I grabbed the key from under a planter, wiped the dirt off on my jeans, opened the door. I knew he wouldn't be there yet. He was on his way back from Boston. He'd texted me when he'd left the conference, which gave him an ETA of 11:15. I grabbed a beer from his fridge, though it was the last thing I needed. I sat in his kitchen, waiting, thinking, anticipating what it would be like when he finally kissed me. I closed my eyes and let my mind wander to how it would feel to be in his arms, to have him inside me, to tell him I loved him. What did I think would happen? I don't pretend not to know. I couldn't imagine my life without him. Aiden starts to ask more questions about that night and where I went, but I change the subject and tell him about my visit with my mother, sparing some choice details, adding others. Aiden knows how she can be, and this causes his face to soften as he draws his hand to the side of my face. I press my palm against it to show my appreciation for his empathy and kindness, and this stirs something inside him. When I get up to clear the plates, Aiden takes my hand, his eyebrows raised, and guides me toward the back stairs. I ask him,
"What about the dishes?"
The dishes can wait. Come on, let's have dessert first.
My stomach churns with dread, but I laugh and climb the stairs, listening to the voice inside me. "Keep going, Brooke. You can do this." But seriously, we haven't had this much sex in months. I pray to God he doesn't get used to it.
that this isn't going to be our life now. I can't do this. Yes, Brooke, you can. You can do this. I can. Yes. I can tilt my head back and moan when he kisses my neck and then my sternum. And when he reaches inside my tank top and cups my breasts gently with his palms, I can find his mouth, his lips and tongue, and kiss him hard and long. We've done this dance for 6 years, and I move through it with ease, but also concentration. When we're on the bed and he's lost inside me, I finally let my thoughts go where they want to. Back to Jeremy and the night we'd planned to be together, how I waited in his kitchen, how the time went by, 10:40 into 11, 11:30, 12. He was 45 minutes late and I hadn't heard from him. I tried calling him, not once, but a dozen times, my voice slowly changing from excitement to concern to worry to anger.
Where the fuck are you? I knew you would do this to me.
At 12:30, I stormed out of his house, walked to my car, and set out to find him.
Chapter 26. Eve, July 4th, 2010. So much had happened since that first week in June when I saw Renee Quinn and met her new boyfriend, Peter Walsh. They'd been there tonight at the fireworks. I saw them walking on the beach with a group of friends. They were all in college. I knew because Renee had invited me to a party at their house after she first arrived. I'd been there several times since. It was a small split level up by the interstate, one of those houses people rent every summer, and for far less money than the ones closer to town and the beach. The place was worn from the overuse, 3 bedrooms, sleeping 5 apiece, 2 bathrooms for all of them, stained linoleum floors, and wall-to-wall carpeting, wood paneling, grease stains on the stove, dirty dishes piled up in the sink. The backyard was in even worse shape, with more weeds than grass, overgrown flower beds that attracted swarms of bees. There were 3 long picnic tables, stained with ketchup and barbecue sauce, spilled beer and rum punch. Ant hills had formed beneath them, little piles of dirt with a hole in the center. They crawled up the legs and onto the wood planks. I always held my cup in my hands. Renee said the house was only supposed to have 8 people, but they had 15 and no one seemed to care. She said the owners were used to it, renting to college students year after year. Who else would want to spend their summer right next to I-95? The cars and trucks speeding by day and night were so loud it felt like the house was right on the shoulder. Renee said it was even worse at night when it would stop for a few seconds and then start again. She had to wear earplugs just to get to sleep. They had named the house Eden, a reference to paradise, because it was anything but that. It may have been a dump, but to me, it was the perfect escape. I never brought Carrie or Brooke there. I felt different at that house of college students, like I was getting a glimpse into my future, away from East Bay, where I had made such a mess of things, and where I couldn't make sense of the people in my life. No one at the Eden house knew me, or what I'd done. I could just be that girl Renee knew, who worked at the inn. Peter was there every time I went. He told me to come out on his boat with them sometime. He kept it docked at the inn. And I did. Those were some of the best days I'd had all summer, even though I took a lot of shit for wearing a life vest the whole time. No one could believe that I didn't know how to swim, living in a seaside town. It's pretty common, actually. People in towns like ours rarely have swimming pools, unless they're rich and live by the water. There were 5 of us on Peter's boat the first day I went. Peter and Renee, me and another couple, Kayla and Will. They were friends of Renee's from college, who had come for the weekend. It was a motorboat with a green canopy and leather seats. The hull and trim around the deck were made of wood. Renee and Kayla laughed when Peter told me it was called a Woody, and then he told them to grow up, which made them laugh more. I smiled, getting the reference, enough to be one of the girls, but not too much because I didn't want to stand out to them, or to Peter. My life felt complicated enough. I just wanted to be anonymous, and that's how it felt to be with Renee and the college kids. Still, I noticed Peter watching me more and more each time I came, the little smiles he would give me when he caught my eye. And this scared me because he was Renee's boyfriend. I loved being with Renee and her friends. I didn't want it to end. Not over a stupid boy. So when Peter came to sit next to me, when he offered me a beer, I got up with my phone and started taking pictures of everyone, and then a video.
Hi, Eve. Having fun on the boat? Of course she is.
Awesome.
Eve, get this. Mwah. Love you, babe. Hey, let's get it rocking.
Oh, yeah.
Guys, no, don't tip us over.
Oh, you can't tip Peter's boat.
Stop it, guys. You know I can't swim.
I posted it on Facebook later that day. Everyone loved it, even Peter. When we got back to the dock, another boy, a man, I suppose, was waiting for us. Or for them, I should say. They all waved when they saw him, and he waved back, then helped with the lines to secure the boat. He was tall, with long dark hair that he ran his fingers through as he pulled it out of his eyes, tugging it behind his ears. I took off the life vest, returned it to the storage space under the seats, and stood on the edge of Peter's boat. I must have looked scared about getting off, which I was. I was always scared of falling into the water. The man reached out and helped me take the giant step onto the dock, but I leapt too fast and stumbled right into him. He wrapped his arms around my body to keep me from falling. My face was pressed against his chest, the soft t-shirt that smelled of cologne and sweat. I stepped away when I was steady, my cheeks burning with embarrassment. Oh, I'm sorry. I don't go on boats very often. He smiled at me and said it was no trouble. The others had already started down the dock toward the inn, carrying the cooler in the bag with the speaker and sunscreen. Renee looked back, calling out to us.
Let's go!
He said he was a senior in college, visiting his friend Will, who was dating Renee's friend Kayla. As we walked, he told me he had just arrived and saw us docking. He thought they were headed back to the house to party. He told me to join them. But I had to work in a few hours, the dinner shift at the inn. He shrugged and told me maybe he'd see me around. Then Renee made us all get in a picture before they left. As I walked to the inn, after the fireworks in the arcade, after my escape from the bathroom window, and now seeing Mrs. Rosario, that creepy wave, I think maybe I will see him around, and the rest of my new friends, when this night is finally over. I'll go to Eden. I'll go back on Peter's boat. Yes, I thought. There was so much to look forward to. And none of it, I was determined, would have anything to do with a boy. It was a relief to think about the future and to stop thinking about Connor and Luke and my fight with Brooke and Carrie storming off. I had to put all of that behind me. I was getting out of here. I was determined. I heard a car coming up behind me, saw the headlights, and my own shadow cast on the pavement just beyond my feet. I moved closer to the shoulder and turned around, waiting for it to pass. I used my hand to block the light so I could see the car. I expected it to pass by me, but then it slowed down. My heart started to race. I was out here, in the dark, alone. No one would even hear me if I screamed. I had never felt unsafe in East Bay. All the times I'd walked home from Carrie's house or the inn, no matter how late it was. But after what happened tonight, I was suddenly terrified. I started to walk backwards, not wanting to take my eyes from the car, but feeling the impulse to move away from it. And then the car turned off, and the lights dimmed. I saw the side door open just as my eyes began to adjust. And then I heard the voice I knew so well.
Eve? What the hell are you doing out here?
I exhaled, hard, with relief, then started to walk the other way, toward the car and the man standing beside it. Jeremy Ashbourne.
Chapter 27. Carrie. July 2nd, 2025. When Jamie doesn't pick up, I leave a message. Call me back. I want to hear what they found on the tip. Thanks. I try to put this out of my mind as I drive back to my mother's house. Staring at my headlights on the black pavement, I turn my thoughts to the new facts that I've learned in the past 2 hours. Renee Walsh was in East Bay the summer Eve died. She was at the Cosmos Arcade around the same time Eve was there, the last place she was seen before she disappeared. Lisa didn't know her, but Luke was right next to Renee in that picture. This is what happens with cold cases. New connections are uncovered. And then people remember things differently. Their loyalties shift as well, the motivation to skirt around the truth fading as they lose touch with friends and lovers. I hit the record button on my notes app and start to make a list. Talk to Luke Kendrick, find out if he saw Renee Walsh at the pier, talk to Bryn Ellis, ask the same thing, see if she changes her story about being with Luke all night. I hit pause before going down the next road. I don't want it to exist outside my head. The road that started with Peter Walsh and Brooke being right next door with her lover, David Paul, who we still can't find. Jamie's convinced the name was an alias. Brooke's lover lying about his name. But why? Just so she couldn't find him in the real world? Or because of something else? Something related to Peter Walsh? I need that warrant for the room. Maybe there'll be fingerprints. Brooke said she wiped things down, but she might have missed something. I hit record again. Call about the warrant. Get inside the room next door. As I pull into my mother's driveway and put the car in park, I see a wash of light appear from the side. My mother is standing in the doorway to the house. She looks at me and shakes her head, holding her palms to the sky.
Where the hell did you go?
I don't answer as we walk into the kitchen. I put my purse and my keys on the counter, then grab the glass that's on the small table by the wall and pour the wine that's been sitting there the whole time I've been gone. The bottle has started to sweat, dripping onto the wood. I take a long sip, then set the glass back down while my mother leans against the counter by the sink with her arms crossed, waiting for my explanation. But she doesn't wait for me to give it. Instead, she launches in.
I saw the box on your bed.
I can explain.
It better be good.
I realize suddenly that I don't know where to start. I decide to tell her the truth. I know she'll see through anything else. I put the box in the storage basement. I really did, even though I don't see how it has anything to do with my marriage.
I've explained this to you 100 times. It's just a gesture. There's probably a mountain of things that he wants you to change, and a mountain of things that you want him to change. And Eve's case, you know, it's right there at the very top of his. I don't think you realize how much you talk about it.
Well, it is the most horrible thing that's ever happened to me. And I still believe someone was with her that night.
Oh, you see? That's what we're all trying to tell you, this belief of yours. It's an obsession. That poor girl drowned.
No, she didn't. And someone else knows it. I let it all out then, telling her about the tip that came in 8 days ago, how it was made with a voice-altering machine. A cheap one, probably bought off the internet. But Jamie is trying to decipher it, and he just made out some words. Her eyes light up when she hears this.
What kinds of words?
They think the caller said that Eve Shea was murdered.
Oh, Christ almighty.
This tip? It proves that I'm right, or that I might be right, and now I have new evidence that I just got tonight, and a possible link between the body that washed up at the inn and Eve's case. Or at least, to Eve. That man who was killed, Peter Walsh, his wife was here the summer Eve died. She was at the pier that night, at the same time Eve was. And I don't believe in coincidences.
Well, what does Rob say about all of this?
I look at her and shrug, and she knows in an instant.
Huh? Oh, no. You didn't tell him.
It just happened.
You said the tip came in 8 days ago.
No, the rest of it. All of that just happened today. Let me just